From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
It's officially hurricane season, and lots of disaster experts are saying it's often best to stay close to home when the storm warnings go up.
Your community centers, your doctors, we want to keep you local. We don't want you going hundreds of miles away, so please make sure you do that.
Also this week, hurricane forecasters have come up with some different looking models to predict where the storms are headed. We'll see what's up with that.
We needed to start looking for a new generation of a model. So that's what we started with.
We'll also explore the potential expansion of amateur athletes to profit from their abilities into the high school realm. And we'll track the progress of a program the Florida legislature set up a few years ago to keep dads connected to their kids. I'm Tom Flanagan, online and on air. This is Capitol Report. Hurricane season began on June 1st, and experts are predicting an extremely active season. Tristan Wood spoke with emergency management experts about how Floridians can stay prepared.
The two-week hurricane sales tax holiday is in effect, allowing Floridians to buy supplies like generators, first aid kits, flashlights, and more tax-free. Leon County Director of Emergency Management Kevin Peters recommends that people across the state take advantage of that holiday before any storms threaten Florida.
It runs through June 14th. So as we start out hurricane season, now is a great time to either replenish our disaster supply kits or get those items that we don't have yet in our kit so we can be as ready as possible this hurricane season.
Leon County and much of North Florida are still reeling from the impact of tornadoes and heavy storms that ripped through the area last month. Keith Pogue is the co-owner of a business in Railroad Square, Tallahassee's Art District. The business was damaged during the storms, and he says he's concerned about this hurricane season.
The weather is just not getting any better. Like, if this is a storm but not during a hurricane season, I don't know if getting hit by a hurricane would be very good.
If forecasters are correct, Pogue's concern is justified. The National Hurricane Center predicts there will be 8 to 13 hurricanes formed in the Atlantic Ocean this year. Forecasters predict there is a 75% chance Florida will be impacted by a hurricane, and 44% chance it will be impacted by a major one, meaning a Category 3 or higher. With the projections where they are, Peters says it's important for Floridians to stay prepared.
You know, first off, have a plan and know what you're going to do if your community is affected by a hurricane. Number two, build a disaster supply kit. Work together as a family, identify what all the unique needs are of each family member, and every family member should really work on building their own specific disaster supply kit. And the third thing is staying informed, having ways to receive hurricane weather updates, emergency alerts, other weather watches and warnings from the National Weather Service, from your local emergency management agency, or from your local public safety department.
Kevin Guthrie, director of the Florida Division of Emergency Management, is asking that Floridians keep their gas tanks at least half full throughout the hurricane season in case evacuations are required.
Why are we asking you to do this? There's always a run on gas. As much as we will get up in front of people and say, do not make a run on gas, it's going to happen. But if we keep everybody at halfway full as a new empty, we're going to cut down wait times in half. We're going to cut down on supply. We'll be able to go twice as long as we need to. So please, again, halfway full is now the new empty.
Guthrie is also asking that people know their evacuation zones. Plans exist to evacuate Floridians from the coasts during hurricanes without having them have to drive hundreds of miles out of the state.
You just need to go tens of miles, get to a safe structure, get away from the coast. We want to save lives, but we also want you to stay, and the governor's firmly committed on this, stay in your community. We want you going to your houses, your churches, your community centers, your doctors. We want to keep you local. We don't want you going hundreds of miles away, so please make sure you do that.
Every hurricane season, videos go viral of some residents saying they will ride out a hurricane no matter if there are evacuation orders. They claim they survived previous storms, so they will survive this one. Peter says doing that is dangerous because each hurricane impacts the area it hits differently. Just because you were safe last time doesn't mean you'll be safe this time.
Treating each storm as an individual storm and not expecting it to be like the last storm, that's really important. We just have to respect every new storm. Each one is unique.
Hurricane season runs from now until November 30th. To get more information about what to have in a hurricane supply kit or how you can prepare, go to floridadisaster.org. I'm Tristan Wood.
Researchers from the University of Miami and NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, have developed a new system for forecasting hurricanes. WLRN's Katie Munoz talked about it with Bill Ramstrom. He's a senior software engineer at the University of Miami NOAA Cooperative Institute for Marine and Atmospheric Studies.
Bill, how do you decide that you need a new system for predicting hurricanes? Where does that start?
So that started, there had been a model that called the HWRF that a lot of my colleagues developed starting in the mid-2000s. And they did a lot of improvements over the years. So, you know, many of those forecast improvements are in part a result of the accuracy improvements from that model. Hmm. But it had also started to run into some limitations where it was hard to, you know, run it on more and more processors in the supercomputers that we're using. And it had some other, you know, limits that we had started to reach. So we needed to start looking for a new generation of a model. So that's what we started with.
And what was your involvement in the development of that system like for the past 5 years?
Yeah, so I moved down here about 5.5 years ago from Boston area to work on this. So I've been building the, basically, we call it a moving nest. It's a zoom-in area that focuses on the hurricane, so at much higher resolution. So just like you benefit on your iPhone camera or something of, you know, more megapixels, you see that your picture looks better and you see more detail. We have a higher resolution, a lot more points over the hurricane than we do for forecasting the rest of the atmosphere in, you know, the larger environment that controls steering flow and things like that. So by having that, we can capture a lot of the details that are occurring in, say, the eye and the eye wall of the hurricane. Mm. You know, when you see the satellite or the radar pictures of those, you see how small those features really are. And so you need, you know, the points in the model to be very nearby to really accurately capture all that.
And this is called the Hurricane Analysis and Forecast System, or HAFS. Essentially, that's your piece of it. What does the whole new model do?
So, yeah, that's we're running two versions of the HAFS model now.
Okay.
They have slightly different settings for things like how the atmosphere interacts with the ocean, how some of the details of processes in clouds work. So, you know, when the liquid water is starting to freeze, and there's a lot of, you know, detail in there, and you can change a lot of those and get slightly different forecasts. And, you know, the forecasters at the Hurricane Center, National Hurricane Center, they like to see several different, slightly different forecasts so they can get a gauge of the level of uncertainty. You know, we give them this model guidance that they use as their inputs, but they're the ones who have to decide on, you know, the final forecast that they're generating. So they like to see a little bit of a range of, you know, in the areas where the academics and researchers are not 100% certain on things, like, all right, let's see answers from each of those options so that, you know, we can understand what's going on.
And really play out different scenarios,
exactly.
It sounds like. Hearing that, I don't know, it just brings me comfort as a Floridian that people smarter than I are looking into the level of detail you just described when it comes to hurricanes.
That was WLRN's Katie Munoz speaking with Bill Ramstrom. He's a senior software engineer at the University of Miami NOAA Cooperative Institute. Coming up on Capitol Report, the times are getting tough for the little independent drugstore on the corner. We'll find out why.
It's just a lot of different elements in the system all at once coming together to make it tough and challenging.
Florida's program to encourage more dads to stay connected to their kids has been around for a couple of years. How's it going?
I really sense that over the next year, we're going to start seeing some more metrics.
As the possibility of some Florida high school athletes making bank from their prowess, not everyone's excited with that prospect. And Florida's traditional citrus crops have been devastated by citrus greening disease, making the producers that are left ever more desperate for solutions. Pharmacists across the state are facing tough times, whether it's more of their patients ordering prescriptions online or lower profits on the drugs they dispense. As Margie Menzel reports, independent pharmacists are worried about staying in business.
Harsh Patel owns CareRx Pharmacy in Tallahassee. He used to manage a pharmacy for a big chain, but says he loves his freedom.
This is my 7th year running, and I'm proud to take care of my patient and try to do anything and everything to take care of them.
But Patel says he loses money on many of the prescriptions he fills, less on generics than on name brand drugs. And that loss has increased within the last year.
I don't know why, because nothing has changed. It's the same pharmacy, same patient population. And I used to fill a prescription for Fycompa. And Fycompa used to lose $20, $30. Now I lose $70, $80 on a Fycompa prescription. And it just does not go well in my brain.
Patel says the new costs have even affected the big chains. He says that's evident when pharmacies across the board are cutting back their hours.
Every single chain is noticing this reimbursement cutting back. So they are cutting back on number of hours they are open. Who is going to suffer? The patient who is needing the crucial medication.
Dr. Ansel Carruthers is the director of pharmacy services and an assistant professor at Florida A&M University's College of Pharmacy and Pharmaceutical Sciences. He says the costs of running a pharmacy are complex.
Just like most patients think, we order the drug, it costs money, and it comes in. But that process, as simple as it may sound, has a lot of different elements to it that affects the retail space a lot.
Instead, says Carruthers, the insurance company might only give the pharmacist a reimbursement that's less than the drug cost. The pharmacy could lose, say, $1,200 a year on that one prescription. And there could be dozens of patients with the same issue, costing the pharmacy a substantial sum over the course of a year.
And so that patient is none the wiser. They went to the doctor today, got a new prescription, got a new diagnosis, trying a new therapy. And they're thinking that, hey, look, my pharmacy is going to get the insurance money and get reimbursed and everything's the same. But that pharmacist or that pharmacy manager has to now realize, oh, now this patient who has been with me for a while, somebody I know their name, I know their family, I know their kids, they're going to cost me $100 a month.
Last year, the Florida legislature passed a bill aimed at boosting transparency for pharmacy benefit managers. But Carruthers says other elements could be at play when pharmacists don't get reimbursed adequately.
It could be the PBMs. It could be the wholesalers and the price that they're giving us. And so those numbers are variable, too. It's just a lot of different elements in the system all at once coming together to make it tough and challenging.
He says the question of whether the pharmacy industry is tough is always relative.
It is a new and challenging way to go about it. You have to think on your feet. You have to see where the reimbursements are and just learn and evolve with the tough times. So it's not that it's impossible. It's not that it's one element over the other. It's a lot of things that come together that makes it tough.
According to Fortune magazine, in 2023, there were more than 4,500 fewer pharmacies than a decade earlier. And the National Community Pharmacists Association said in February that several thousand more pharmacies, up to a third of its members, could close this year. I'm Margie Menzel.
Attorney General Ashley Moody is continuing to warn Floridians about the dangers of fentanyl use. The synthetic opioid, which is 100 times stronger than morphine, is being mixed into other illegal drugs and sold to unsuspecting users. This week, Moody is reminding Floridians that Naxalone, a medication that counteracts fentanyl, is available over-the-counter at pharmacies throughout the state. She says those who may have loved ones struggling with addiction should make sure to have the medication on hand.
With the sheer volume of fentanyl that has flooded into our state, we are going to have to educate our citizens on how to obtain and administer this life-saving medication for those that overdose.
Moody says summer break is a time when kids are vulnerable to illegal drug usage, either from friends or from being online and talking to digital drug dealers. According to the CDC, more than 7,000 Floridians died from drug overdoses in 2023. The latest U.S. Census Bureau stats show that the majority of households with children in this country remain the two-parent variety. But one out of four households with kids have only one parent. Far and away, that parent is called mom. Combine that with poverty, repeat over several generations, and Leon County Sheriff Walt McNeil says you've got the recipe for kids dropping out of school and committing crimes.
Our crime sometimes deals with generational crime, and that means we failed several years ago to address some of the issues, and they crop up today.
It's mostly the boys who follow this crooked path, says McNeil. And he says one reason is because they lack loving, positive male role models in their lives. In other words, a dad. Kids can sometimes turn to their peers to help fill the void, but often those peers don't provide good guidance. Second Judicial Circuit State Attorney Jack Campbell says these groups of young men often reinforce their own worst instincts and get into big trouble.
They don't want to call law enforcement when one of their friends gets shot. What they do is they and their friends will then arm themselves and they will go and resolve it. A few weeks ago, we had three shootings within 12 hours on a weekend. None of them contacted law enforcement or cooperated with us. Instead, what they did is they went and they and their friends gunned up. That's how one shooting turns into two, it turns into three.
So in answer to the question why so many young people are involved in crime, Mark Merrill, the founder of Tampa-based Family First, says just look at how many single-parent homes there are today.
We're seeing about 18 million kids that live in the U.S. don't have a father involved in their life, specifically a biological father. If you think about that stat, that's enough to fill New York City twice or Los Angeles four times over.
During the 2022 Florida legislative session, lawmakers passed and Governor DeSantis signed the Father First Bill to encourage more biological dads to stay with their children by funneling funding toward programs aimed at supporting dads. The legislation put Merrill's organization in charge of implementing the law.
Family First and our All Pro Dad program was challenged and given the responsibility to implement this initiative called Father First Florida.
Lawmakers set aside just under $69 million for the program. Merrill says part of that is going to public awareness campaigns to promote responsible fatherhood.
We're also doing it on the ground at the community level through a network of, so far, 30 community organizations that we've brought together and that have been provided funding through this legislation.
Organizations like Boys and Girls Clubs, Children of Inmates, Be Strong International, and many others, Merrill says these groups supply the actual services.
Provide mentorship programs, one-on-one support, help them with counseling, child custody issues, and so many different things, even for incarcerated dads.
As Father First Florida heads toward its third year, Merrill says it's still a bit early to judge its effectiveness as it tries to reverse many generations of family dysfunction.
We're already getting a lot of input that people are starting to pay more attention to this issue, and these community organizations are serving more and more men and families and children. I really sense that over the next year, we're going to start seeing some more metrics and KPIs of lives being impacted.
KPIs standing for Key Performance Indicators, which is a fancy way of saying more kids and more dads being together. There's a new era in amateur sports where student athletes as young as 14 could soon land lucrative endorsement deals. That's true in at least 30 other states, and Florida could soon follow. The Florida High School Athletics Association recently adopted a policy that would let high schoolers be paid for their name, image, and likeness. However, as Adrian Andrews reports, there are concerns about how that move might impact schools.
The FHSAA stands ready to help its student athletes succeed in this new sports and business landscape.
That's Monica Colucci, the president of the Florida High School Athletics Association. She says the Sunshine State is behind when it comes to NILs. 30 other states, including Georgia and Louisiana, already allow high schoolers to profit off their NILs. At the FHSAA's recent board meeting, directors agreed to let student athletes find deals with their parents as long as they do so without the deal being attached to the school they attend. That's because of concerns explained by Alan Shirley, a school principal in Sumter County. He says schools may fall victim to false recruitment violation accusations and other issues.
That actually will put liability on the school and or the school district for potentially a claim that they somehow meddled in the contract negotiations or pulled away from what that student could have earned.
At the collegiate level, colleges, boosters, and other related groups can help steer deals to players, but Kimberly Ritchie, the senior chancellor for the Florida Department of Education, says that could get out of hand at the high school level unless certain guardrails are put in place.
I think what we're okay with is supporting the athletic program and directly engaging in NIL activities. We might be allowing them to engage in collectives, which we would not be okay with.
A 2021 ruling by the NCAA and the Florida legislature granted college athletes the use of NIL deals. Tallahassee State Senator Corey Simon supported the law's expansion. The former collegiate and pro football star says athletes are part of the, quote, money-making system.
Now is the time for them to step up and see the athlete for what it is, which has been a money-making machine for the system.
Sports analysts say Florida's decision to expand the original college NIL law by allowing coaches and departments to get involved directly may have led other states to start allowing high schoolers to be paid, sparking the latest round of policy changes in high school sports. Last year, WFSU asked Childs High School Athletics Director Mike Edo about high schoolers receiving NILs. He described it as the, quote, wild, wild west for programs seeking highly skilled talent. He believes the fight over big endorsement deals will lead to more players transferring.
I understand where they're coming from. You know, of course, NIL is based basically off of your performance. So if you come to a school that, you know, they're not very good at, now I can see people trying to transfer.
Under Florida's new rules, companies that advertise products like alcohol or drugs will not be able to offer high school students deals. Other restrictions include the banning of NIL collectives from school boosters and using school property in any NIL deals without permission from a school district. The proposal has been sent up to the state's Department of Education for approval. I'm Adrian Andrews.
And we got another story on that subject, too. The Florida High School Athletic Association, as we said, has taken the first step toward permitting name, image, and likeness deals for high school students. And under that proposal, teens can profit from their name, image, and likeness without risking their athletic eligibility. Brandon Scobie spoke with members of the community to get their thoughts on the potential change.
Carolyn Dickens is a Tallahassee mother. Her children used to play high school sports. She has mixed emotions about NIL for high school athletes. She fears NIL deals could open the door to bad actors.
There's always that the chance that there could be, because I've seen how, not necessarily corruption, but I've seen how it has affected, seems like it has affected the play in college and the way it has affected college sports. I'm not saying, I don't think it should happen as young as high school. I just don't think it's a good thing.
Keenan Rivers is a high school student. He has a much more positive outlook on high school athletes getting NIL deals.
Well, the good thing is if they do get hurt, they have money to, like, sit back on. And, you know, I think they should get paid for, like their likeness or something.
The proposed new policy does have a few rules intended to keep students safe. Students and parents are responsible for negotiating these NIL arrangements together. Students violating the NIL policies could risk their eligibility to continue playing sports. I'm Brandon Scobie.
You're listening to Capital Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, the price of oranges is skyrocketing. Florida's orange harvest season is wrapping up, and numbers from the Department of Agriculture show orange production in Florida is down more than 90% from the peak back in 2003. A major factor in the drop is a tree-killing disease with no cure called citrus greening. Molly Jurig reports researchers in Central Florida are leading the search for solutions with genetic engineering technology.
Steve Crump is a fourth-generation Volusia County farmer. He says oranges were always his family's main crop ever since 1883, when Crump's ancestors resettled here into Leon Springs from Illinois. But nowadays, Crump says his orange production is down 80% compared to 15 years ago. For that, he blames one thing in particular: citrus greening, a bacterial disease spread by the invasive Asian citrus psyllid insect. Most trees die a few years after being infected.
Everything that should work and used to work isn't working like it's supposed to.
So Crump is getting creative. He takes me inside the best citrus greening defense he's come up with so far, a 2.5-acre enclosed screenhouse he built about 4 years ago, complete with roof and roll-up door.
We're growing citrus inside to keep the insect out.
Crump says the citrus trees in here grow much larger than they ever could outside this greenhouse, which so far is keeping out the invasive citrus psyllid. Or at least it was.
This is unbelievably great way to grow trees until you have a hurricane, and then the roof splits and the sides blow in and the bugs come.
That's what Crump says happened in 2022, when hurricanes Ian and Nicole tore through the area just a few weeks apart. Back then, Crump had to repair the damaged screenhouse. Once, then twice. Still, he says he didn't notice anything wrong with these screenhouse trees until earlier this year.
I saw citrus greening inside, and some of the trees are infected. So that was discouraging. It takes about 14 months for the disease to show up in the tree, so I guess it was on schedule.
At the University of Florida's Institute of Food and Agricultural Sciences, or UF-IFAS, microbiology and cell science professor Nian Wong says his lab is the first in the world to develop citrus applications for the gene editing technology CRISPR. Wong says you can think of CRISPR as molecular scissors, which cut citrus plant chromosomes, trying to remove genes that make the plant vulnerable to citrus greening.
You want to make sure, hey, you know, what is responsible for the disease, right?
So far, Wong says his team's narrowed it down to 40 genes that could be causing citrus greening. With CRISPR, the tricky part is removing those genes without harming other good genes, like ones that help a tree yield good quality fruit.
I think we're getting close.
Wong says earlier this year, his team took more than 120 CRISPR trees out of the lab, planting them in Central Florida fields to test their resistance to citrus greening. Final results are still a ways off.
It's kind of a long, slow process of the disease development, right?
But Wong is optimistic. So far, he says all the CRISPR trees in the field are doing well, not showing any signs of citrus greening. He hopes to know more about their long-term resistance to the disease next year.
Where we're going to drive just a couple hundred yards to an orange grove.
Back at the DeLeon Springs farm, Steve Crump shows me one of the groves where he says his family first started planting orange trees more than 80 years ago.
These orange trees used to live a long time.
But citrus greening decimated those original orange trees, and today the ones growing in their place are much younger. Crump says right now he needs to remove about half of all of his trees after citrus greening made them unproductive. Meanwhile, as scientists keep searching for a citrus greening solution with CRISPR, Crump just hopes they can pick up the pace.
It's very discouraging. I know how to grow an orange tree. Or at least I used to know how to grow an orange tree. I really don't anymore.
In Volusia County, I'm Molly Durig.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Adrian Andrews, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, Margie Menzel, and Tristan Wood. Thanks also to Katie Munoz, Brandon Scobie, and Molly Jurig. Technical support for Capitol Report comes from Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. We hope you'll join us again next week on air and online for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.